Pasuk Tes Zayin. We're in the middle of the descriptions of the opulence, the wealth, and the tremendous power of Shlomo HaMelech. What is the point of describing in detail how much gold he had and all the various things that he had that we're going to be discussing next week, Sukkim? So we mentioned the Mefarshim say that it's to show how HaKadosh Baruch Hu kept his promise to send bracha if they follow in the Torah, and to show that Hashem will give you bracha in this world if Klal Yisrael keeps the Torah. And the truth of the matter is, all this stuff is not really Schar Mitzvah. Chazal tell us Schar Mitzvah Ma'ayal Malekah, that the true reward for mitzvahs doesn't take place in this world. There are certain things that Adam Olchel Peroseim Ba'olam Hazeh Vakaren Kayem Salam Abba, that there are certain dividends, peros, that you get in this world, but it's not the actual Karen, it's not the actual reward itself. So all that's described here is at most the peros, it is not the true schar. So it gives you a little bit also of the concept of what schar really is. And it's a it's something that's very difficult for us to imagine. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter makes a mathematical calculation, which doesn't really tell us what schar is either, but at least it gives you a little bit of a context. He says as follows, that the when it comes to punishment, there's a concept that Gadol Oncho Shel Lava Me'oncho Shel Tcheles, that the more difficult it is, it says that the punishment for not keeping the white threads of tzitzis is greater than the punishment of not keeping the blue threads. Why? Because the blue threads are very expensive and they're difficult. The white threads are simple. So the more the easier it is to do something, and if you fail, the greater the punishment. The more difficult, the less the punishment. So is picture the following scenario. A person has built, has spent his entire life building up a business, building up his assets, and he's now, after many, many years of hard work, he's very comfortable. And now he's faced with a situation where he has to violate a lo sase in the Torah or lose all his money and well, be back in poverty. Can you imagine you could give the whole tzior, you know, fellow on the Lower East Side with his push cart, you know, and all kinds of weather, and he's selling his merchandise and he works his way up and he finally rents a storefront. After a while he has a store, and then a bigger store, and then several stores, now he has a whole chain, and he has a nice house, and he has everything, and he's been working 30, 40 years to get to where he is today. And now he's in a situation where he has to say one sentence of Lashon Hara, or else lose everything that he has, be penniless, back with his pushcart. So the halacha is that you're not allowed to say the Lashon Hara. Right, the only thing that is matter lo sase in the Torah is pikuach nefesh, danger to life, but danger to money is not permitted. So that's halacha. So supposing he couldn't withstand the nisayon, he couldn't withstand the challenge, and he said the one sentence of Lashon Hara in order to save his entire life's work. That means he's going to be punished, because he did something wrong. But on the scale of punishment, which end of the scale is in? On the upper end or the lower end? It's obviously on the much, very much on the lower end of punishment. He deserves much less punishment because it was such a difficult nisayon. That punishment has to be more severe than the pain he would suffer if he gave up all his money. Otherwise, it's not a punishment. I remember my early days in Florida, we had a storefront. The yeshiva was in the storefront. We had the classrooms in the front. Then we had the base medrash, and the dining room was in the back. And the only way you could really get from the classrooms to the dining room was going through the base medrash, which was disruptive to the fellows who were learning the base medrash. So we had a rule that you had to go outside the building and around the back door to the dining room. Needless to say, this rule was sometimes violated. So we had a system, you know, there were certain punishment assignments you had to do if you were caught walking through the base medrash. So some of the fellows would hand in their assignments in advance. I say, okay, here's three assignments. I got three trips through the base manager. So if the punishment is not more severe than the consequences of keeping the mitzvah itself, then it's not a punishment. So you can imagine what kind of agony it is for a person to give up a lifetime worth of work and become penniless. So that's the punishment for the least of the averis. So you can multiply that if the averis is more serious. But meruba midas harachamim midas hadin. The Chazal make an equation that rewards are 500 times greater than the punishments. Because it says by a chet, a Kodesh Baruch Hu remembers the chet for four generations. And by a mitzvah it says la alafim, which is 2,000 generations. So that's a 500-to-1 ratio. So it gives you at least a mathematical concept of what a reward for a mitzvah is. Even the slightest mitzvah that deserves the least reward is 500 times more if you make this kind of than the tzar, which is going to be much greater than losing your lifetime worth of work, because otherwise it's not a punishment. So there is the real schar for mitzvah, olam haba, is beyond imagination. And all these descriptions of the wealth and power, prestige and luxury, everything that Shlomo has nothing to do with the reward. That's only the peros. Doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. Still in all, it's still unusual, because generally the derech of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to hide his hand in this world. There are different reasons for that, but the most fundamental reason is to preserve Bechira. You know, if there would be a very obvious relationship between reward and good deeds and punishment and bad deeds, then it would really restrain people's free choice. It would be too obvious, it would be too compelling. However, from time to time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does reveal his hand, and it seems that it doesn't stop the Bechira, because we will see later that there were certain tainus on Shlomo Melech, and Klal Yisrael ended up regressing despite all this luxury. In the Bayis Sheni, there's actually a similar, not quite the same, but similar sequence. In the time of the end of the era of the Chashmonaim, there was an infamous Russia, it was a king, it was Yanai. And Yanai had a gripe with the Chachamim of his generation. He killed a number of the members of Sanhedrin. Others ran away. The one great gadol of that generation who remained in Eretz Yisrael was Rav Shimon ben Shattach. The reason he remained was because his sister was Mrs. Yanai. Yanai was married to Rav Shimon ben Shattach's sister. And therefore he had protection, and it was safe for him to remain, or somewhat safe for him to remain in Yerushalayim. Chazal basically relate the story that when Yanai died, Rav Shimon ben Shattach's sister, known by various names, Shlom Tzion and other names, became the queen for a period of a number of years, and she actually ruled the country. She was a righteous woman and followed the Torah and restored the Chachamim to their position. And during that period of time, they were blessed with unusual prosperity. Not only that, it says they had adequate rains, but the rain used to fall on Friday nights when people were not traveling. Rain has a downside. It's very inconvenient. Especially, you imagine, you know, you didn't sit in the car with your windshield wipers. You had to ride on your horse or your donkey. It was extremely difficult to travel in the rain. The pavement wasn't always so good. You know, you had mud, this. So the rains used to come Friday nights after everyone got home from shul, sitting for the Suda Shabbos, and there was it was a bracha, v'nasatis gishmechem bi'itam in the ultimate time. The Gemara relates that the barley would grow to the size of a fruit, the grains of barley, because of the prosperity, and the quality was, everything was wonderful for this 670, whatever it is, 3 or 7 years, I don't remember how many years she was queen. So, and then when she died, the king, next king took over, reverted back to the evil ways, and all of a sudden it stopped. So you would think, that Hashem's hand is obvious. You had all this struggling, you know, for parnasa, struggling for produce crops, and all of a sudden, when you get this queen who follows the Torah in office, everything was wonderful. When she goes out, back to where it was before, and yet people don't take the lesson. So there is a tremendous capacity for bechira, for choice, and we somehow manage, you know, to find reasons and excuses and to ignore the obvious. And I say over the example of, I remember, as a youngster, back in 1967 during the Six-Day War, when the war was beginning, you had all the experts who were getting, you know, making all these predictions and evaluations of what was going to happen, and basically it didn't look so good for Israel. In the opening days of the war, you were getting these news reports from the scene. So Israel was announcing these ridiculous numbers, you know, like we destroyed 160 Egyptian planes and didn't lose a single plane of our own, you know, and Egypt was coming with their numbers. We destroyed, you know, 120 Israeli planes and lost 7 of our own, or whatever it is. I remember hearing this, you know, military expert, you know, a retired general, on the radio, say, obviously both of these claims are ridiculous and the truth lies somewhere in between, you know, and they're going, as it turns out, the Israelis' ridiculous claims are all true. It was very unfortunate for Jordan that they didn't believe them, because Jordan did not join the war immediately. Originally it was Syria and Egypt. And in fact, a message was sent to Jordan through a third party that if you stay out, we'll stay out. But they were hearing all these reports and they thought it was only a matter of time before Israel was destroyed, and they wanted to get their piece of the action. So they joined in as well. It didn't work out exactly as planned. But all the experts were saying it's impossible. So what was it then? You would think it would be obvious that Siyad Hashem. And then afterwards, well, you know, this happened and that happened, and, you know, they figured out this and they figured out that, and all of a sudden everything, you know, is explained away. So it's a capacity that human beings have to explain away everything, and it preserves our bechir and preserves our choice. In fact, Chazal tell us, and this is something that's hard for us to understand, but apparently can exist, that it's possible for a person to actually believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu completely and accept his existence with clarity and still rebel against him. And we have several prime examples of this. The first one is Nimrod, who haya gibor tzad lifnei Hashem. So Chazal say that Nimrod had the same hakara of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Avraham Avinu did. But he was hikir as baro umiskaven livot bo. He recognized his creator and he decided to kick, to fight against him. Chazal tells us that Nebuchadnezzar recognized HaKadosh Baruch Hu and fought against him. So there is such a mentality that a person could have, that to recognize Hashem, I want to fight him. Like, what do you mean, you're fighting Hashem? You know, you would think he doesn't believe, he's an atheist, he's about a Zara, whatever. But it's possible. There's something about human nature that preserves this independence, even in the face of what would seem to be ridiculous positions, although generally HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not make Bechira that difficult. So that is the other side of the story, so to speak. Right. Though there are differing views about Paro, that's why I didn't bring that example. Hashem Hikshas Libo, what does it mean? But at least according to some of the interpretations, Paro was pretty much the same thing. Okay, Pasuk Tezayim. Vayas HaMelech Shlomo, and the King Shlomo made Masayim Tzina Zahav Shachut, 200, how you translate this, shields, I guess, but the Mepharshim describe it, they were almost like body armor. They were three-sided shields that covered your front and the sides, and you were sort of stood within it. So, and they're made out of Zahav Shachut, beaten gold, or gold that's worthy of being beaten, in either case, meaning that it was very, very fine quality gold. Now, I'm not a military expert, but I think everyone knows that gold is a relatively soft metal and is not really the greatest material to use for a shield. So these shields are not really intended for military use. This is part of the display of the wealth of Shlomo to show, you know, again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's bracha. And we'll see they weren't really used. They were stored in the king's, or displayed in the king's palace. Sheish Meo Zahav, 600 gold measures or coins, whatever they may be. Yala Al-Tinachas, that's what, how much it took to make each individual one of these shields. Ushlosh Meos Maginim Zahav, these are also shields, but these are the handheld variety. I noticed in the English they were translated as bucklers. I don't know what a buckler is, but I assume it's a handheld shield. Also, made out of Zahav Shafa, beaten gold. Shloshes Manim Zahav, three portions of gold, Yala Alamagen, Achas, for each shield. Vayitem HaMelech Beis Yar Levanon. And the king put it in the house of the forest of Levanon, which was the king's summer home or palace. We mentioned, if you remember, when we were discussing the buildings that Shlomo HaMelech built. So these were basically, again, a demonstration of the bracha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're not really intended for any type of military purpose. Now comes, the next few psukim come, the description of the famous throne of Shlomo HaMelech. There's an entire history of this throne after it was built. We'll get to that in a few moments. But a kind of a postscript. This spectacular throne of Shlomo, there is a story by Rabbeinu Gershon, Mor HaGola. Its sources are somewhat murky. It is not clear whether this story is a true story. It became very famous, but there was a famous German storyteller, Marcus Lehmann, who wrote a number of books, and he wrote this story. He must have had some sources for it, but in terms of traditional sources, the Chuvas, whatever, there is no indication to this. But there must be some type of tradition or source to the story. And the story goes, Rabbeinu Gershon, of course, is famous, just a historical note, Rabbeinu Gershon is considered to be the spiritual father of Ashkenaz, of the Ashkenazic Jews. I don't really want to break this to us Ashkenazim, but Rabbeinu Gershon was Sephardi in origin, as was everybody, really. The Gemara started in Bavel. Bavel is the Sephardic regions. And this Tekufa, which was at the end of the Gaonim, the center of Torah during the entire period of the Gaonim, was in the Sephardic countries, in Bavel and in surrounding areas. But those communities were beginning to be fall apart and be persecuted. And there was a scattering of the Chachmei Bavel. There's a story also somewhat, there are sources to this, but the details are somewhat lost in history, of the Arba Shevuyim, four captives. People were kidnapped and redeemed in various communities and started different communities. But what usually, if you look at the history of the Mesorah, the father, so to speak, of the Sephardic Mesorah was Rabbeinu Chananel. And the father of the Ashkenazic Mesorah, Rabbeinu Gershon, they were contemporaries of each other. Rabbeinu Gershon started off, I believe it was in Greece, perhaps, I'm not sure. The historians could look that up, but he was in a Muslim country. And it was in a Sephardic area. And eventually he had to escape, and he went to Germany, and he became the leader of the German Jewish community, and through his Talmidim and so on, came the tradition of the Ashkenazic Jews. Rabbeinu Gershon is famous for some of his charamim, his takanos, amongst which was the fact that a person should not marry more than one wife. Other famous haramim is that you can't give a get without the consent of the wife. That you're not allowed to read somebody else's mail. And various other takanas that Rabbeinu Gershon made. So there's supposed to be a story behind Rabbeinu Gershon's takana about two wives. And the story goes that he was in this, I think it was in Greece, I'm not sure exactly, but this country, and he was an advisor to the caliph, to the king. And of course, as is usually the case, when a Jew reaches prominence, there were a number of non-Jews in the government who were rather jealous of him, and they couldn't really do too much about it. Story goes that Rabbeinu Gershon was married to a wife but didn't have children for a long period of time. And the wife suggested that he take a second wife, as Sarah suggested to Avram. So he did. At that time, this king got it into his head that he wanted Shlomo's throne. He read about it in Tanakh, and he was very impressed, and he wanted. So comes Rabbeinu Gershon, if anybody can make the throne, it's you. I want you to make this throne. So first he tried to say no, but he was pressed. He said, okay, he's going to do it. So there's a huge project, phenomenal amounts of gold, and went into building the throne. I don't know if they made it out of ivory, as the Pasuk says, but at least there was definitely gold. And he made this humongous throne. So his enemies used this as an opportunity to try to attack him, because so much money was spent on this throne. They accused Rabbeinu Gershon of siphoning off the money, taking some of the gold for himself. So the king was a little bit upset because it was over budget. You know, I guess they had that problem then also. And he began to suspect it. Now, the truth is, Rabbeinu Gershon also suspected that some stuff was being stolen, but he didn't do it. He had plenty of people working on the project, and it was impossible to manage and watch them 24/7. And he also assumed that stuff was stolen, but he knew that he didn't do it. He said, how are you going to prove whether things are missing? So let's weigh the throne. And we know how much gold was spent, and we'll see if it matches. One problem, they didn't know how to weigh the throne. It was a huge thing. You couldn't fit it in any scale. They couldn't construct any kind of scale that could weigh the throne. So the king comes to Rabbeinu Gershon, I want you to weigh the throne. Again, he says, how do you weigh such a throne? It's too big. Can't be done. The king suspected Rabbeinu Gershon knew how to weigh the throne, but he couldn't get the answer out of him. So the story goes that this wife, the second wife, who was being bribed or whatever the reasons were, finagled and pushed and so on, finally got him to tell her how to weigh the throne. What was the answer? He said, you take the throne and you bring it to a ship. You mark the water level on the ship, then put the throne on it and mark the new water level. Take the throne off the ship, make sure it's at the old level, and then you could put, you know, stones or anything you want on the ship and weigh it down until it hits the same mark. Then you could weigh those stones and add up the totals and figure out how much the throne weighs. See how much water it displaces. So she revealed the secret, and they weighed the throne, and sure enough they discovered that a significant quantity of gold was missing. So they blamed Rabbeinu Gershon, and they decided, and he realized that she had betrayed him, but, you know, it wasn't much he could do. So they decided, because of his service to the king, they weren't going to kill him by chopping off his head or hanging him or anything as gross as that. They locked him in a tower, and he was going to be left there to starve to death. Very kind. So the tower was a very tall tower. It was impossible in those days, at least, to reach the... And he was in the top of the tower in the prison. So his loyal wife came by, called up to him, and said, "What is anything? I want to help. What can I do?" So he said, and I don't remember all the details. I didn't have time to find the Marcus Lehman book. But my recollection from my youth is that the basic answer was that he told her to tie a thread to a certain type of a worm or a caterpillar that climbs up. And when the caterpillar got to the top, he had the end of the thread. To the other end of the thread, you tied a string, that the thread could bear the weight of the string. So he pulled up the string, and to the string, he tied a thicker string, and so on, until he was able to get a large rope up to the tower. So on the bottom of the rope, you attached a bucket with food and drink and so on, and she supplied him. He then told her to send him up a file or a tool so he could get open the bars of the window. Eventually he was able to do that. Then he tied the rope to the bar and let himself out. Now I think they disposed of the rope somewhere. Maybe they burnt it. I'm not sure. This I don't remember. But I do remember the story goes that there was no evidence of how he got out when he left. They snuck out, basically, and he went to Germany at that time. They come back to the tower to retrieve the dead body, and there's a couple of bars missing from the from the window and no Rabbeinu Gershon, and they decided it was some kind of miracle and they better just leave it alone, and that was the end of it. But he ended up in Germany. So we do know that he started off in Greece and ended up in Germany. We don't know exactly what transpired in between. But it all came about because of this throne that he was enamored with.
What happened to the throne?
What?
What happened to the throne?
What happened to the throne? All right, we'll jump the gun as long as you ask. The throne was captured by Shishak. Let me get the sequence here. Shishak was an Egyptian king, and he captured the throne after the death of Shlomo. It was returned to Eretz Yisrael by Asa, the king of Yehuda, and it remained in Eretz Yisrael until Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Nebuchadnezzar took it to Babel. Chazal say that Nebuchadnezzar sat on that throne, and as did Koresh, the Persian king. From Babel went to Madai. Ahasuerus tried to sit on the throne, and he couldn't. It wouldn't let him. And that was because he wasn't really royal. You could be a Rosh and everything else, but you have to be a king of the world. You have to be a Gavra. You have to be a person who really has control of the world. Ahasuerus didn't quite match, right? So Ahasuerus built a replica. And that's why the Pasuk says, Kisheves HaMelech Ahasuerus al Kisei Malchuso. Why does it make a point of him sitting on Kisei Malchuso? He says he had to make his own throne. He tried to use Shlomo's throne, it didn't go, so he made his own throne. Kisei Malchus wanted to fool people to thinking that he was sitting in Shlomo's throne. From Babel went to Madai, from Madai to Yavon, and from Yavon it was taken by the Romans, and it's supposed to be, along with all the other hidden treasures of Rome, the remnants of Shlomo HaMelech's throne. There is people who have said that they saw it. It wasn't apparently intact anymore. But supposedly, it might be hidden someplace in Rome. So if you ever get it passed to the catacombs in Rome, you could take a look, see if you could find this, amongst other things. Yes?
Is this the throne that Ahasuerus could not move?
I don't know about moving. It says he couldn't sit in it. All right, so let's take a look at what this throne was and what it represents. You go ahead.
What happened to the throne Rabbeinu Gershon built?
That I don't know. I'm sure it wasn't exactly the same as Shlomo's in any case. You know, there are many things here that were miraculous in nature, but it was close enough. The king was very happy with it. So it says, Vayas HaMelech, and the king made Kisei Shein Gadol, a great ivory throne, by Tzapeus of Mufaz. And it was covered with fine gold. Sheish malos lakisei, six steps led up to the throne. Ferosh ogul lakisei, and there was a rounded canopy or head to the throne. Me'achorav, in the back, that's behind where you sit. V'yados mizel mizel, and there were arm rests on each side. El mekom hashevis, that extended to the area in which you sit. Ushnayim arayos omdel etz hayados, and there are two lions by the sides of those armrests. Ushneimasar arayim, and there were 12 lions, omdim sham, that were standing there, al sheish mailos mizeh umizeh, on each side of the six steps, two at each step. Lo nasa chein l'chol ha-mamlachas. There's no such throne for any kingdom. Now, when Chazal get through with this, we see that this was much more than decorative lions. They actually spoke. When you stepped on the throne, certain pronouncements came out of the throne. And when you sat on the throne, certain pronouncements came out. We will get to that in Mirtz Hashem. We'll see if it'll be this time or next time. Firstly, there's a point of the six steps. And Chazal talk about what was the significance of the number six. So there are, how many explanations? Because it come out to six? One, two, three, only five. The Medrash gives five significances to number six. There should have been six. I don't know which one is missing. But
it's leaving one for you to add.
I guess so. One of them is as Keneged, the six heavens. Sheish Rakia. So now you will say, but there are seven. The answer is the throne itself was the seven. And the symbolism of this is that the purpose, the primary purpose, and we saw this before by David HaMelech as well, the primary purpose of a Jewish king is not political, but it's Torah. And his job is to judge the country al pi Torah. So the kisei represents this justice, this judgment. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kivayachol sits, so to speak, in the seventh heaven and judges everything below him. So there's the throne, which represents the seventh heaven, and the six steps are the six levels below him. It seems as well that there's a parallelism, that there are seven, I don't know what you call it, seven levels of Adama, of earth. We find seven different terminologies in the Psukim, referring to the world. And again, six plus one. And the Medrash, in fact, quotes the Pasuk, Yishbal Tevel B'tzedek. Tevel is one of the seven. That's where the justice takes place. So the throne was Tevel. And the other six steps represent Eretz, Adama, Araka, Gei, Tzia, and Neshia. These are the six terminologies for the world besides Tevel. So that's another significance of six. There are, of course, Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. That refers to the Torah. There are 6 days of Maisa Bereshis. There are six Imahos. All right, that took a second. That includes Bilhah and Zilpah. And the last... Oh, there is a sixth interpretation. Look at that. The last one is the six mitzvos that particularly apply to a melech. We'll discuss that a little more length when we get to the speech of the steps of the throne. So those are the actually six interpretations of the number six. They are all closely related to the idea of a king having this role of being Dan Din Torah. For example, Chazal tell us that a person who's Dan Din Emes La'amito Nasa Shutuf Kadosh Baruch Hu B'Maisa Bereshis. You become like a partner with Hashem in the world because it sustains the world. So that's the idea of six days of Bereshis. It's also the Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. That's how you judge, based on the Torah. Right? It explains the six heavens and the six earths. Again, you're sitting on the throne and judging those levels. I'm not sure about the six Imahos. One can make a loose connection because that was the foundation of Kali, so were the Gimel Avos. I'm not sure exactly, you know, the significance of that. And the six mitzvahs of a melech also primarily pertain to his role as a judge. So this throne, which represented the judgment of Shlomo, was therefore having the six steps. The point of that is also important. Part of the way justice works is because the people accept it. For example, there's a number of qualifications that Moshe Rabbeinu had, Chazal tell us. He was tall, right? He was wealthy. What does that have to do with being Moshe Rabbeinu? A Navi should have these qualifications. Why? Who cares if he's tall? Who cares if he's wealthy? But the fact of the matter is, human nature is that they accept it more. A person is wealthy, people listen to what he has to say. A person is tall, has an imposing appearance. Right, gives you a big advantage in the election. I remember there was in the debates of the last election, so George W. Bush is tall and John Kerry is not short, but he's shorter than Bush. So they were very machbid in how the podiums should be placed during the debate, so they shouldn't be so close to each other, so you shouldn't be able to see that he's taller. You know, the image makes a difference in the way a person is makubal. So if you have this enormous, impressive, imposing throne with all the various things that it did, the person sitting on that throne has a certain authority even more than he would have otherwise, and therefore people accept the justice. Once people refuse to accept, then din breaks down. So that was part of it too, is to make this imposing appearance on Klal Yisrael. Now, what did this throne say? We'll start from the top, then we'll get to the steps. When you sat on the throne, if you were able to, apparently the throne didn't let just anybody sit on it. I'm not exactly sure how it stopped you, if it was the lions, if it was the yados, whatever it was. But if you sat on the throne would say, Da lifnei mi ata yoshev. Know before whom you are sitting. And you're sitting before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're sitting up in this imposing throne, and you're the king of the world, and you're wealthy, and you're powerful, but you're standing before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Everything you have is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you are here to be his servant. So that was the message when you sat on the throne.
Where's the noise? Where's the speech come from?
Speakers.
From the lions.
From the lions.
I guess there were speakers in the lines. Is that what you said? It was solid state circuitry because it must have been battery powered because there were no plugs. It's an important message, again, very difficult because a person has that kind of power, it could easily go to your head. And the truth of the matter is, we will see that there was some impact on Shlomo, at least in his older age, of all the various wealth and power that he acquired. But he built this throne to present him with this reminder of who he really is and where he really stands. And it's reminiscent, really, of the Chazal about David HaMelech, that David HaMelech compared himself to Hagar, who was wandering destitute in the deserts of Yehuda, even though he was sitting on the throne, the most powerful man in the world. But he understood that everything he had comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and in a split second, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want him to have it, it would be gone. So there's no such thing, really, of having that type of power and wealth. And there is a story told, a little bit of a Hasidish story. I don't remember who the Rebbe was involved, nor do I remember the pasuk that he quoted. But the essence of the story was that there was a wealthy individual who had a number of factories in which he employed a lot of Jewish people in the factories. And when he was older, he gave each one of the factories to one of his sons. He had like 10 factories, 10 sons. And he still had plenty of wealth left over himself. And he came across a pasuk that basically, again, I don't remember which pasuk it is, but the pasuk said how HaKadosh Baruch Hu could lower the mighty and could raise up the downtrodden in a second. And he came, there are many such pasuk, I'm not sure the specific one he quoted. So he came to the Rebbe and said, I don't understand. How could HaKadosh Baruch Hu possibly lower me? He says, I'm a very wealthy person. Let's say HaKadosh Baruch Hu caused me to lose all my wealth. I can understand he could do that. But I have 10 sons, each one of those sons is independently wealthy. So they would certainly help me. So what's he going to do? Because the Kadosh Baruch Hu is angry at me, he's going to make all of my 10 sons go broke. And those 10 sons, they have many, many workers who work for them. I think he maybe even owned the factories, but they worked the factories, but many workers, they should all lose their parnasa just because the Kadosh Baruch Hu is out to get me. His hands are tied. How could he possibly take away all my wealth and not affect everybody else? So the Rebbe said to him, HaKadosh Baruch Hu would do anything. You can't say that.
But Shlomo could make him sick. I mean, it would be like he's...
I don't know, but he was talking about the wealth alone, not other things. He could kill me, that I understand. He could do other things. What about the wealth? Anyway, so he comes home that evening, and he wakes up in the evening, and he's in some type of a trance or daze. He finds himself walking across town and bangs on the door of the neighborhood galach, the neighborhood priest. Wakes the guy up in the middle of the night. Priest opens the door, looks at him. He recognizes him because he's a very prominent Jew. He says, what are you doing here? He says, I want to convert. What do you mean, you want to convert? That's ridiculous. So you're the head of the Jewish community. You got all this money, all this power, why would you want to convert? I want to convert. So I'll tell you what, if you really want to convert, you sign this over all your property to the church, then you come back in the morning, I'll baptize you, I'll take care of the whole deal. He takes out a piece of paper, he signs all his property over to the church, comes back home, and now wakes from his daze. And he realizes what he did. He says, now what's going to happen? He's penniless. He's not going to go through with the conversion, but the church is going to have all his property. Who's going to help him? He went and signed everything over to the church. Everyone's, his sons will have nothing to do with him. The community will have nothing to do with him. He'll be ostracized. He'll be alone in the world. He'll be penniless. And none of the factories closed. Nobody lost any jobs. Nobody lost any money. And it happened. And he didn't know what to do. He goes running to the Rebbe. I guess in the middle of the night, he wakes him up too. And he says, "What should I do?" He tells him what happened. So he says, well, the second part of the pasuk says Hashem could raise up the downtrodden. So just as Hashem could bring you down, he could bring you up. Go daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's all you could do. So he stays up the rest of the night, davening, saying, till him, wakes up, you know, he doesn't wake up, he's up the whole night, but in the morning he notices there's a commotion going on the other side of town. So he goes over to see what happens. A fire had broken out in the priest's home. Burnt the whole thing down, including the priest, including the paper, including everything, and he's off the hook. But the point of the matter is to recognize, to be able to understand that everything you have comes from Hashem and could be gone in a second. Is a very difficult thing to do when a person is in a position of power and wealth. And this was the reminder that Shlomo HaMelech had built in to his throne. Yes.
Wasn't there like a bush or something, like Shlomo HaMelech to get
mutter
from a fake lion?
I don't know about that. If anything, it's kind of you know, it's a miraculous event. You know, the mutter is I don't know, it's a busha. Why should it be a busha? Parkeret, it's not a busha to understand what human nature is and to know that you need chizuk.
He already has a sefer Torah on that he's already carrying him with, so this is another
correct. Now, what each one of these steps had a message as well. Different versions in the Medrash, but when you stepped on one of these steps, the lions on that step would deliver a message. There are, in essence, two versions in the Medrash. One of them is in Bamidbar Rabbah and Esther Rabbah, and the other one is in Devarim. The easier version, was that each one of these steps announced a mitzvah that was particularly relevant to a king. So on the first step, they would say, Lo yir b'lo nashim, shouldn't have too many wives. He walked up to the second step, he says, Lo yir b'lo susim, not to have too many horses. The third step said, V'kesef v'zav lo yir b'lo, shouldn't have too much money. By the way, a very interesting aside on that, well, let me just finish the six steps, see what we get to. Then, the number four said, Lo satem mishpat, you shouldn't corrupt justice. Again, the role of a king is to dispense justice. Lo sakir panim, you shouldn't show favoritism. And then, Lo sikach shochad, you shouldn't take bribes. So these six mitzvahs, three of them are particularly to a king, and the other three, in essence, are to a judge, which is the role of a king as well. So those are the, each step pronounced one of these tzivuyim. Now how, lo yar b'lo nashim, it's easy to understand how that could affect him, and it did, as we will see later. But what is the impact of the susim, of the money? A king shouldn't do that. And the pasuk is mashma, the sefer of the pasuk is, and the mefarshim say this, that v'lo yarum levavod, that he shouldn't become a bagaiva. So a king has a lot of money, it can cause him to become a bagaiva. And I find that kind of interesting because if you were to tell me that a normal person who has money becomes a bagaiva, that's very easy to understand. You're wealthy, it gives you power, people, you know, fawn all over you, people listen to what you say. So obviously you think that you must be some brilliant genius and some big, who knows what, that you're able to amass all this money. So it easily could lead to gaiva, to arrogance. But a king doesn't really need the money to have all these things. A king, especially in those days, I mean, king and had life and death power. And he could condemn somebody to death just because he said so. And therefore, people were fawning all over him anyway. And were listening to him and they were mocking of him. He doesn't need to have the money in the bank. Plus, he has the ability to collect taxes. If he ever does need money, he can get it whenever he wants. He doesn't have to worry about a budget. So what is the difference if he has tons of gold sitting in his treasure houses, or he doesn't have so much gold sitting in the treasure houses, but he can get it whenever he wants, and everyone is bowing to him and listening to him and doing whatever he wants anyway. So if all those other things don't lead to gaiva, What difference does it make that he has more money in the bank? And apparently it is such a profound impact on human nature to be able to look at the money and see it's there already. You know, open up the chest and there's the gold, there's the jewels, I have it. And it makes him feel up as, otherwise all I am is a king of the entire world with life and death in my power and maybe a couple $1,000,000 in the bank. But now that I have $1,000,000,000 in the bank, oh, now I feel like I'm something. For you and I understand, because we don't have $1,000,000,000 in the bank, who are we? But you're the king of the world. Like, what do you need the money in the bank for? But still, having that money in the bank is a whole different madrega. And it's a whole different nisayon that the king has to watch out for. So much so that there has to be a special mitzvah in the Torah, the kesef izav lo yir b'lo ma'odi. He's not allowed to take excessive amounts of gold and silver. We will eventually have to discuss why Shlomo Melech apparently violated all three of these things and what exactly happened as a consequence. But that will have to wait for a later date.
Two quick announcements. One important